This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get. Except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week is Justin Davis, Scoop. Sam Claiborne.
Hey, everybody.
And making his first GameScoop appearance, Tom Marks.
It can't be his first.
Scoop.
And he's our PC editor, and his favorite game of all time is...
Oh, God. Skies of Arcadia is usually my... Skies of Arcadia, my wow. Legends is usually my go-to answer there.
Yeah. Is that on GameCube?
Yeah,
that
one? GameCube. Okay, originally for Dreamcast, Legends was for GameCube.
But you say that's your go-to answer...
Yeah, it's my go-to.
Is that what's in your heart?
It's that complex question of, like, that is definitely my answer in terms of, like, at the time I played them, effect they had on me, long-term, all that stuff. Yeah. Probably I've played better games than that since then.
Well, but that's like, not how favorites work.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's true. Super Mario 64 is my go-to answer.
Yeah.
But if I meditated on it for three straight days, I might emerge with a different answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Wait, is that just like a turn-based RPG in 3D?
Kind of, but it's also Sky Pirates.
It's Sky Pirates.
Like one of my favorite aesthetics ever. Mm-hmm. And then there's also these like super cool turn-based ship battles where you're like fighting space like or pirate ships in the air. It's just awesome.
It's got a cool pirate bounty system where you're hunting down other sky pirates.
And you played on GameCube?
Yeah, I played on GameCube.
Man, I missed this entirely. So my question is, what happened to the series?
It went away.
Yeah, it wasn't really a series.
Is that a Sega game?
Because it was a Dreamcast game that just got like one of the games that like caught the lifeboat off of the Dreamcast and made it.
Did it have II in it?
It did not. It's also another game that is, I talk about this a lot on Scoop, that's sort of trapped on an old platform. Like, you can't get it on Steam or anything like that. Like, yeah, I gotta have a GameCube or Dreamcast. I don't think it ever got remastered or ported.
Three of the characters are in Valkyria Chronicles, but besides that, nothing.
I bet they'll remaster it or something one of these days.
Now that they've heard this episode.
I know. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Sega's usually a big fan of what we have to say about their games on this show. We've got a great show for you this week. We're going to talk about Hawaii.
Been there.
We're going to talk about Sea of Thieves. But first, Ubisoft, ubiquitous software. This week they detailed just how much more money they make on their games as a service as compared to their one and done traditional games.
Yeah.
This is in some earnings that they shared this week. So, you know, they release a game typically, traditionally, it makes most of its money in its first year, right? Yeah. And then in its second year, that game will make 13% of what it made in its first year.
Interesting.
A game as service, though, makes all that money in the first year, and then will make 52% in its next year what it made last year. So it's just like, it's so much more money.
Damon, that's 39% more.
It's a lot more, yeah. So when people wonder, why is everything a gosh darn game of service these days? That's why. They just make tons more money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's solved.
So we got that. Wow. That issue's laid to rest. Uh-huh. It's just like the school board meeting, right?
I don't want to get into that on GameScoop. It's funny that it's a monkey's paw situation where gamers for years have wanted more. Like, my favorite game of all time is Super Metroid. And it's like, what if they added new planets and new weapons and new areas for you to explore? And that's what gamers always claim they wanted. They just want to keep playing their favorite games forever and have those games be supported forever. But then the way that we finally get that wish is it's like twisted around in a way that, like, you know, it's all packed with microtransactions or, you know, all kinds of catches and side effects.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, do you have a feeling, any sort of opinion on games as a service? Like it, don't like it?
I generally like it, but as with all things, I like it if it's being done responsibly, right? Like,
sure.
I mean, like, if we're going off of Ubisoft, like, Rainbow Six Siege is one of my favorite games right now. It's the FPS I play the most of right now. And, like, that game would not exist if it had just stopped in the first year. Like, the amount of content it's gotten, the amount of updates and fixes and all this stuff that it's gotten since launches made it become one of my favorite games. But then at the same time, I look at a game like The Division and I'm just like, I'm way less interested in a game like that as a service. And, like, I would much rather The Division had been more of, like, a linear story thing that I just play once and stop and, like, not had to deal with all the online stuff and the Dark Zone. I wish the Dark Zone had been more of, like, a dedicated PvP thing than, like, this area within the open world, right? Like, so I'm not opposed to games as a service, but it does make me worried about if this is just what games are now, like, what is that going to do?
Yeah. Well, in addition to sharing how much more money they make on games as service, they also share that they make a lot more money off their digital games, perhaps not surprising. Now, 56% of Ubisoft's total revenue comes from digital sales of games and content.
More than half.
That is more than half. I'm glad we have a mathematician here on the show. I don't know. It's interesting. So their ideal customer is someone who buys their games digitally and then just plays just those games.
Well, Ubisoft in particular is very notable for this. And, you know, they're lauded for this by me and others for sticking with Rainbow Six Siege launched fine. You know, it was a good game, but not exceptional. But they stuck with it through updates, big and small. Small quality of life improvements and just sort of chipped away at the parts of the game that maybe were not so excellent. And then lo and behold, you know, a year or two later, they have an excellent game. And although they did have that weird thing with their pricing recently that they got a lot of blowback for, in general, has supported the community in a way that, you know, was both beneficial to their business and to the community playing that game. And they're in a similar boat with For Honor. They're
For Honor,
really,
like, still gaining players, isn't it? Like, they're like 7.5 million
they're
people playing that game.
They're not giving up on that game. Yeah. I think a lot of people have given up on For Honor, and they are not. They're giving it dedicated servers now, and they're really going all in.
That's what I mean. Like, kudos to them for doubling and tripling down on a game that they believe in, and instead of looking at the numbers and spreadsheets saying, well, look, this one just didn't work out. And instead, they really seem to be willing and able to go that extra mile to ensure that a game they believe in gets its chance.
But what I like about Ubisoft, and I think is unique about them, is that here they're demonstrating how much more money they make on their games as a service, but then they're also dedicated to more traditional games like Assassin's Creed Origins and Far Cry 5.
Well, mm-hmm. I would put Assassin's Creed Origins in that games as a service category. I mean, maybe not to the degree that, you know, For Honor is, but they're having weekly. That game absolutely has live events, you know, things this weekend only, fight this big boss, and events that seem to come and go. And they're opening up new high level areas months after that game released.
And I know there is a lot of content that they have planned coming down for Assassin's Creed Origins. That's interesting. I don't really think of it as a game of service.
Yeah, like does Zelda count as a game of service?
I mean,
they have the two pretty quick DLC packs, and they're kind of spread out.
Yeah.
I mean, Assassin's Creed in particular has weekly events, which I don't know, like, what the delineation or demarcation for,
I think,
like,
there needs to be a community involved, right?
Yeah, maybe. A high score event, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, you know, I was talking to Sam about this earlier this week. The games as a service model kind of flies in the face with how gamers traditionally played games. Like, when we were growing up, you would play a game, finish it, and move on to the next. Because I love video games and I want to play as many as I can. So I kind of liked the whole process of playing through a game, putting it up on the shelf, and then trying out the new game. But now games as a service is like, just play this one game. And it's at a time when there are more games available than ever, right?
It's interesting. I've always prided myself in, like, saying, like, oh, I'm going to try as many games as possible, know a lot about a lot of games, and, like, really kind of, like, experience the library side of video game playing. I really like that. I collect games too. So I actually have a library. But that is, you know, something that developed from when I rented games at the store when I was a kid. And, like, I'd go there and be new games, I'd be really excited, and like go and like for, you know, $2 or something, take a game home for the weekend, and a new one every time until I found one I really liked, and I stuck with it for a while. But it's like you get this huge experience of games, and like maybe that you could say that like games of service is saying like, don't just stick with one, don't play all these other games and you're not having other experiences, but it's on you to make those other experiences. And we have things like Steam now, which make it so much more possible to play many, many games for so cheap. Like, we kind of have both worlds right now.
Yeah.
And it's kind of up to your tastes. And then, you know, I think there's some self-improvement and stuff to be had. And if you want to write about games or think about games, you want to play as many as possible.
Yeah.
I definitely don't want to hire people that only play one game, you know.
So unless that's their beat.
Unless that's their beat, which if we only have three games in the future and we all only play those, then we'll definitely have to have people that only play those games.
I mean, I
like thinking of games as a service also, like, I like playing them kind of cyclically, right? Like, Warframe is a game where I will come back to Warframe every few months and get really obsessed with it for a while and then go, like, just stop, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that that game is dead to me. It just is like, oh, I'll see what they have, what's new. You know, maybe they'll update the game with a new thing and then I'll just come back to that. And then, you know, I'll drift off of Warframe and I'll be playing Siege for a bit, and then I'll drift off of Siege and I'll be going back to Overwatch for a bit, right?
Like, do you find your friend groups move with you through those?
It depends sometimes. Like, I have a lot of my friends more recently have like started to dip off of Siege, right? And before Siege, they were all playing PUBG, right? Yeah. And so I'm sure at a certain point, PUBG is going to come back to the top of that cycle, and like we're going to be playing that again. I think that it does bring up a key thing though, which is like all the games I just mentioned, I have way more fun playing them with friends than I do on my own, right? Like,
sure.
All those games, I think games as a service kind of encourages that, is that idea of like you said, the community,
yeah,
right?
That's your friend
group. Social experience.
It's your social side of it, which we always had with like GoldenEye and stuff like that in the pre-internet era. For sure, like couch co-op was a big deal. And like, I always liked those games, but it doesn't mean I stopped playing Mario 64 as soon as Super Mario Kart 64 came out.
Yeah.
Tom just touched on something important, which is, you know, putting down one of these games. I think I'm a casual or maybe not so casual Destiny fan. Like, I like Destiny 2, the shooting, the lore, you know, everything about that game, but I'm not the type of person that's going to sit and play with it for years and years like the people on the Destiny subreddit. I think that community is kind of whiny, actually. Or they complain about, like, I'm out of things to do. And it's like, that's fine. You know, like, that game doesn't
owe
you. Too
bad there aren't any other games to play.
Yeah, it's like that. Destiny 2 is new, but it's still, what, 4 or 5 months old? So, you know, if you're tired of it, if you feel like it's run its course, or you're feeling a little burnt out on it, like, you don't need to go onto the Bungie forums or that subreddit and complain. Although I understand that's coming from a place of passion and you just wish there was more you could do with the game. So I get that. But that attitude has always just been so interesting to me. It's like, that's fine. Like, don't play it. Come back in a year when the next expansion comes out. Like, that's how I play. Like, I don't play World of Warcraft, but I do, because I pick it up once every other year and play for 2 or 3 months. And then that's my cycle with that game that I've settled into. Yeah. Like, it's not like I'm a WoW player or not a WoW player. Like, I dip back into it.
Mm. Well, that's also, it's interesting because that's an expectation that has been built up by other games, right? Like, in a weird way, Minecraft ruined it for everyone, right? Like, Minecraft got such consistent updates for so long and, like, really popularized this model of, like, I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, it basically invented early access, or it, like, popularized early access and allowed people to do that sort of thing. And then, you know, you think of a game also like Terraria that did a similar thing where for years and years, and still that game is just getting content updates. Mm-hmm. So that when a game like Stardew Valley comes out, you have people complaining, being like, yeah, you know, once you get to like the 60-hour mark of Stardew, there's really like nothing to do. And it's
that's
like
where I am right now.
Right, and that might be true, but also you spent 60 hours in that game. Yeah. It's like not every game needs to be Minecraft coming out with new content.
Like
all
the expectation
the time.
That every month there's going to be a new crop or new town event or something.
And to their credit, they are working on some updates from Stardew Valley, just not as many and as frequent.
Yeah. What, a two-player update that's still coming?
It's four-player, actually.
Four-player.
Wow. So there's like flamingos or something?
Some single-player content.
I missed the flamingos.
Yeah.
Or flamingos.
The purple boat. They're making
yeah,
a magical
they're making
purple
some,
boat.
Some, some secret purple boat. There is content coming to Stardew, but it's not like, you know, it's just a content drop. It's not like that's not a game that's seeing new things added to it on the regular.
One of my followers on Twitter, Alan Billingsley, had an interesting question about this whole games as service topic. He says, I think it would be interesting to discuss how these games as a service will age. In 10 years, will Destiny be running on fan servers, maybe with fan-made content, or will they just be shells of games because so much of the game was stuck in loot boxes? I don't know. It is an interesting something to consider. Like, in 10 years from now, what is Destiny? What is Warframe?
I think the first part of that is significantly more important than the second part of it. I think the loot box question is, like, you brought up, at first you were like, you know, will these games even be runnable? And will they have loot boxes? It's like, will these games even be runnable? Yeah. Like, we already see games shutting down because of this. I mean, Mojang's, the developer of Minecraft, Scrolls they had this card game that they stopped developing like 2 or 3 years ago.
And MMOs, you know, I mean.
Yeah, and that's finally shutting down. But one of the things the Scrolls team is trying to do is make a server tool that the community can use so that when the game does officially shut down, the community can run their own servers.
That's cool.
I'd love to see that happen for more games going forward.
It should just be a standard practice, right?
Yeah, it should be.
Like, we're not monetizing our game anymore. It didn't work out for us. Here, we've open sourced, you know, whatever element of this that we can for you to just take it on yourself.
There's just no financial incentive to do that.
Yeah,
well,
unfortunately.
That's true, but there's also no financial disincentive. Like, presumably, if it's not a business for you anymore, like, turn it back over to the community.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. I wish you could just give them all your files, but it seems like you have to actually make that work, which costs money.
You do. They were in the Scrolls example, again, they were saying, like, we cannot just give you the source code. If we give you this, like, that is something we can't do. And I'm sure that came from, like, Microsoft directly, right?
Well, where's Microsoft and Mojang going to scrounge together the money to do this anyway?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's definitely elements of, I mean, even in Destiny 1, these games as a service, just a complete, you know, disregard for, maybe it's been a positive, a willingness to just not keep the product static. And Destiny 1 at launch is not the Destiny 1 that you go back and play today. They replaced the voice, Tyrion Lannister.
Yeah,
And Nolan North does the voice of the ghost now. And so you just can't find, like, that Destiny 1 that you played for the first year or whatever is gone. And World of Warcraft is another example. The World of Warcraft you played at launch is gone, and the Cataclysm expansion revamped all those quests and all the whole old world. Yeah. And
so, aside from even hosting those and making sure that they run on a, you know, a shared server, you also need people to play them. Mm. And so, you know, think of yourself in a library in 50 years. You want to play Destiny 1. You could probably conceivably get it up and running, but it's empty. You know, and like, what's actually there to play? So, you know, you're going to be playing robots. That's what you're going to be playing.
It
worked in Perfect Dark.
Yeah. I do see, like, I mean, games like Quake and you know, Quake has proved that there's still value in being able to, you know, like, last year, I think it was, I was in a 20-man Quake server playing Quake 2, like, you know, with a bunch of people. And it was like, if you just tried to, like, go on to Quake, you couldn't be able to. But, like, if you find the right group who wants to do that sort of thing, being able to jump into a game like that would be really cool. That if you were,
we
like,
need the Library of Congress to help us out here.
I'm all for that.
I completely agree. I mean, it's, video games are weird. They're a weird, different medium than everything else on Earth. You know, a video game can be a 2-minute experience on your phone or a 1,000-hour experience on your PC, and, like, that's part of the challenge. Like, Dan complains about reviewing games all the time, where, like, it's the equivalent of the same person reviewing, you know, a television show and a movie and a Vine, you know, all on the same review scale.
That's really good.
Like,
we should start reviewing Vines, by the way.
6 out of 10. Okay. And then the other part of that is, you know, the preservation aspect of it. You know, games that are required to be online are required to have other people to play. It adds to the transient nature of the medium. It feels less permanent than, like, a song is a song forever.
If it's happened already, I'd like to hear about it if you're listening and can tell us. But I'm curious if people have wholly resurrected an online game.
They have with MMOs. Is it City of Heroes?
Like, it had to go, like, completely dark, and then they said, like, somehow we're going to get this up and running.
Can you emulate it? Has there ever been an...
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is that even possible? You could emulate?
Well, there was the bootleg pirate WoW servers for a long time, and then one that was, like, maybe semi-official, but they eventually shut down, and now Blizzard's doing it officially.
Yeah.
Finally, thanks to fan demand, they're bringing back, you know, World of Warcraft vanilla classic servers.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
I wish I could recall the name. There's absolutely fan-run MMOs that were shut down and then resurrected by the community.
What happened with APB? Remember that one? Did they turn that one over to?
I thought that game was still, like, technically still playable. Didn't they make it free? Oh, no, that was Brink. They made Brink free.
Brink is free.
Which was the technically a sequel, but not really, to APB.
Are all the EverQuests still running?
Yeah.
Yes. They still put out content.
Well, it's funny that one and two are running concurrently. Yeah, I think one is maybe more popular.
Daybreak still does like weekly or monthly updates of that game. They're real small, but they still do it.
That's an example. Like, if that game, because of the passion that's still around for EverQuest 1, like, you can't conceivably see, even if they shut it down, like, somebody will figure out how to run EverQuest.
What about which one was I just? Man, I was just thinking.
What about the bad ones?
I was going to say Ultima Online. Is that still a thing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Ultima.
That's still running.
Ultima's Online. RuneScape's still around.
What's the Mad Max one?
Mad Max?
Mad
Max MMO?
No, there's like a there was a popular. It crashed right away, but it was like a Road Warrior type MMO. Well, that's one that's definitely gone.
I don't know.
I don't remember that one.
Man, what was it called? I'm just trying to think of ones that are. I mean, there's probably.
I mean, I was really fascinated. I went through a phase where, because I really loved Lord of the Rings Online, and like as much as I love that game, I would totally say it's a B-tier MMO. And I got fascinated with, like, you know, Asheron's Call and, like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons Online was Turbine as well. Like all those sort of B-tier MMOs and like what happens to them when they die. And the smart ones or the elegant ones, they shut down the game in like a graceful way and have an in-universe reason. They usually spawn like a bunch of mega beasts and like some storm or something. Ending,
Do they really do? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, and then everyone congregates together and like celebrates the end of the world. And it's like, like sort of happy, but it's also bittersweet because then like the lights turn off. Like then the server turns off and it's like, oh, then you can't get back on. It's just over. But then the crappier games are the ones that don't care, don't have the time to get something together. It's just gone. Matrix Online.
Oh, yeah. The Matrix Online.
That's a good example. Like, could somebody get that going again?
Don't know.
I don't have the answer. Can they?
Let's give it a whirl.
There's hope, but I think it's a very small flicker.
I mean, it's just interesting to think, like, if we set out, you know, with lots of money to resurrect a game like that, you'd have to purchase the rights and do all the stuff.
Yeah, that way you could. I mean, you could bootleg it. Anyone with enough time could bootleg it.
Really,
I
think there's probably you have the game code.
There's probably pirate servers of most MMOs out there.
Wow,
that are worth still, you know, preserving. Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. But speaking of loot boxes, Hawaii has become the first U.S. state to officially propose legislation to prohibit loot boxes in video games.
Nice. Mm.
The bill, the text from the bill, cites the recent World Health Organization's move to consider gaming disorder a disease. And the bill reads, these predatory mechanisms can present the same psychological, addictive, and financial risks as gambling. This is being spearheaded by Democratic State Representative Chris Lee, who has described Star Wars Battlefront 2 as a Star Wars-themed online casino.
Yeah.
Is that accurate, Tom?
I mean, there was a Star Wars-themed casino in the new movie, so maybe it's just that.
Lee,
very diplomatic answer.
There's those dice in the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, that's true. Lee says, I grew up playing games my whole life. I've watched firsthand the evolution of the industry from one that seeks to create new things to one that's begun to exploit people, especially children, to maximize profit. And according to Lee, more than half of U.S. states are currently considering some sort of loot box legislation. So there's four bills in total. The first pair aim to prohibit the sale of video games containing randomized rewards to consumers under the age of 21. And then the second set of bills seek to establish disclosure requirements, including probability rates for publishers of games that feature loot box mechanics.
So I think that
the first part of that seems like it would cover a lot more games than loot boxes.
Yeah.
That's the problem with legislation like this, right?
Well, we don't have the. I mean, Damon's paraphrasing the legislation, but the
randomized rewards. You say?
Yeah,
you think that covers more?
Yeah.
Like at the end of Super Mario Brothers 3 levels. This is the star.
I mean, even Diablo is randomized.
I mean,
everything.
Yeah. I mean, the second the disclosure to me. So here's the deal: like, this is a nuanced, complicated issue.
Yeah,
you cannot like loot boxes, and then in that same thought, have a second thought in your head that they should not be illegal. Like these are two, like, because that's the spot that I'm in.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
I don't like them. You know, I don't think they're healthy for the video game industry. I also don't think I sound like someone else, but I don't think the government should be, you know, telling me what to do or, you know, mandating that I'm not allowed to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Even though I don't like it.
Yeah. The ESRB stance is that loot boxes aren't dissimilar from trading cards, from Magic cards.
Those. Ban them all. No,
I think
pinball was banned for the same reason, and those laws have had to be overturned in every city in every state, and they're so stupid.
Yep.
Yeah. They're about like, wasn't this there... is a gambling machine and it doesn't involve skill, so we're going to ban them. And they're banned everywhere. And like, to, you know, until a couple years ago, yeah. my wife was involved in turning this over. You weren't allowed to have more than like 10 pinball machines in under a roof in San Francisco yeah. near a school. So
but put them outside yeah. and you're fine.
yeah. It's like, it's just. I'm exaggerating, but it's exactly what it's like, and you know we probably don't need to legislate.
I think disclosing the drop rates is the key. Like, yeah, so people understand. So people have the full knowledge before you know they push the button and put in $5 to understand: do I have a 10% chance of getting the thing I want, or a 0.1% chance of getting the thing I want?
Yeah,
that feels like a no-brainer.
Also, I think in some cases making it a little more difficult to actually press the button to buy is a fair complaint. Mm-hmm. Like, I think a lot of mobile games, there are examples of mobile games that will very much incentivize just press a button and you spend $5 magically. And it's like that sort of stuff is targeted towards kids. Like, just in the same way that you were saying you can hate loot boxes and not like this legislation, the same exact thing of you can think that there are exploitative practices that need to be fixed and hate this not like this legislation. Like, both of those things can exist. This is a really scary thing to me in the same way, because like, I think there are a lot of times where loot boxes make games fun. And I think there are a lot of times where loot boxes are used responsibly and are make a game better. And I hate that this kind of zeitgeist happened where everyone was like, witch, burn the witch, burn the witch. And like we're, you know, putting loot boxes up on this like burning pyre. Stake. Yeah, this pyre, because it was like, you can't just like ban them all. Like, I think that's such a heavy-handed and short-sighted way to solve this problem, because it damages so many games. And also there's the side of this where it's like, well, what if they don't just ban loot boxes? What if any game that has a loot box now can't be sold to somebody under 21? Then it's like, okay, developers aren't going to stop making loot box games. They're going to keep making loot box games. It's just that kids aren't going to be able to buy them anymore. And it's like, that's not like a good fix to this problem. It just means that like it means that the 18-year-old out there who wants to play the shooting game is like not going to be able to play the shooting game anymore legally. And it's like, this isn't a solution. There needs to be a better, more long-term solution to this.
You also, you know, there's, you know, this isn't a particularly political show, but there is the element of, you know, is it the government's place to be telling, you know, any artistic endeavor what they can and can't do to begin with? You know, the ESRB is not the government. You know, that's the games industry self-regulating itself and saying, look, we're going to put on our own boxes. I mean, it was sort of at the government's, you know, nudging. They said, look, you need to do this, so we're going to step in and get involved. But the games industry took care of itself and said, look, you know, we will make this proactive change on our own. And the consideration of, it looks nice on paper to say, okay, no one under 21 can buy these games. Like, cool. But then that puts the onus on every single, you know, small developer, anyone on earth making a game to know the age of all their customers, which they might not always know. And like, there's, it's complicated. All this stuff is always more complicated than people sort of make it out to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so frustrating. And I get so kind of worked up about this whole conversation.
I get.
Because I do agree that loot boxes are a problem right now in some cases and in some regards. And I do agree that like...
Can you provide an example of where you think it's a problem?
Well, I think that the Battlefront thing rubbed me way the wrong way. Sure. And to their credit, at least for now, they haven't turned those back on, right? Anything that has power and randomization, I generally dislike. Something like Overwatch, honestly, I don't think Overwatch is a problem with its loot boxes. I think that game is 100% all its randomization is cosmetic, and it gives you a system to not participate, like to bypass that, and I think that's great.
So I agree with you. Like I would put Overwatch in the good pile. Like, here's an example of loot boxes done right. But even so, like, when you get a duplicate piece of gear in Overwatch, it turns it into gold instead that you can then turn into, like, you can spend that gold on more gear. But they designed the system and they didn't have to give you duplicate gear at all.
Well, yeah.
Like, sure. So we all,
that's one of the problems.
We just hand wave away this stuff, even in like the good games, like when they have control over the whole spreadsheet of what drops and what doesn't. Like, it's like, oh, you can spend the currency that you get on your dupes into more stuff. And it's like, but no one even stops to take a step back and be like, well, wait a second. Like, why does it have to even be that unfriendly?
But like, does it bother you when you buy a pack of Magic cards and you get a dupe card?
Well, there's a couple differences there. They don't know whether I have a dupe card or not, you know, and Blizzard does. And those have monetary value that I can then turn around and sell. You know, that's a physical thing that I own, and I have a closet full of Magic cards that I could turn into $5,000 if I wanted to or needed to.
You should do that.
Yeah, $5,000.
I may have exaggerated that. It may, if my wife is watching, please, it's not.
You just open the closet and just, they all just pile out.
And the part of this that we haven't really touched on that I also do think is a problem is like, yeah, I think that some of these things exploit, especially a younger audience, and I think some of these systems exploit people to just be pumping in money, and that's where the slot machine kind of metaphor comes in of like, you just keep putting in money hoping to get a reward somehow, and like, I think that stuff needs to be at least fixed, or as you said, made more transparent, because one of the things that has happened is China has mandated that you reveal drop rates already. They already did that, and we started getting drop rates for things like Overwatch and Hearthstone and these bigger games, but like, I agree with Justin. I want those in the game. I want them right next to the button where you buy the thing. It says, here are your odds. Like, I think that is something that needs to happen, and I think that's something that's not going to happen because of this legislation.
That legislation was passed. Oh, man, I wish I could remember the game, but a game lied. They're like, you know, you have a 3% chance of getting this ultra desirable thing, and then, you know, they did a it wasn't actually 3%. And before that legislation, you're completely at the mercy of the developer to trust that, you know, they're not manipulating you. And, you know, generally, I'm a fan of Blizzard. I trust Blizzard insofar as I trust, you know, any game developer. But what's the temptation on their end to, you know, they know what the desirable thing is going to be. And to withhold that to a greater degree than some of the you know, skins or voice packs or whatever that people maybe they know don't care about as much, to try to get another $5 or $10 out of people during seasonal events. An example of bad loot boxes, I don't even have a specific game, but it's the time pressure, right? This weekend only, there's a special thing going on, and you have a 1% chance of getting what you want, and then that likelihood that people are going to put in another $10 or $20 or $100.
The Plants vs. Zombies Heroes game does that a lot. It's always timed events. You only have this weekend to get this special card.
No, they all do. Like, they all do it. But that's not that, and that mixed up with not knowing what the drop rates are, or not even knowing if they're being honest about the drop rates they are giving you, creates a pretty gross stew.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about Hawaii, but then we talked about that.
Hawaii is the first state.
What's up with all those chickens in Hawaii? It's weird.
Yeah, there's wild chickens running around.
Is this passed already?
It's just been proposed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Hawaii is the first state to officially propose this legislation.
It's not the government's business. Sorry.
I agree with you. I agree. But moving on to another game with we'll have microtransactions. Sea of Thieves is out March 20th. It is a full $60 game. And we had a story on IGN this week about how they do plan to add microtransactions 3 months after release.
Okay.
Well, I know. But some of the microtransactions sound kind of cute. Someone from Rare was saying, we thought long and hard about what's right for our game experience, and the key thing, we think, is that it has to add to the fun, social nature of the game. So anything in this area will not impact power or progression, and you'll always know what you're getting, so that means no loot crates. The first paid content for the game will come in the form of pets. It'll either be on a shoulder, like a monkey, or a cat on the ship. But it'll kind of benefit everyone socially and emotionally. So if I've got a cat, I can pick it up, look at it, or you can pick it up and run off with it.
Cool.
I really, really want to allow us to fire cats and other animals out of cannons.
Well, okay.
As long as the cat wants to be fired out of the cannon.
Beyond that, Rare is looking to include potions that can alter you cosmetically, like a potion that turns your character model old for a certain amount of time. The mission statement is that microtransaction items have emotional value, not mechanical value.
Yeah, I mean, how funny. They're copying the exact World of Warcraft playbook on that.
Interesting.
In terms of cosmetic pets and stuff like that.
That you can buy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
the Pepe, the owl?
I mean, there's a million of them, and sometimes they benefit charity, and I think sometimes they don't. And,
Some of that stuff actually sounds kind of fun, stuff I'd want to play around with. But I wonder, like, why isn't it there at launch, I wonder?
I feel like there's always the perception of microtransactions at launch that it's like, oh, this is just gated day one content that you're making me buy. Why isn't this in the game if it's already here? And, like, probably they're trying to stop that a little bit. Like, because if there is I personally don't have a problem with microtransactions like that. If you want to sell little cosmetic things just that are, like, little premium items, that's, like, the type of microtransaction that doesn't bother me. But there are people who I understand the mindset of, like, if I buy a $60 game and there's all this content in it at launch when I buy it, why is some of it, why do I have to pay more for some of it?
Why didn't I get the cat?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, and I, so I understand that mindset too. And I think they're probably just trying to head that off at the pass, right?
I think they probably also know, you know, they have some sort of data that tells them the type of person that's willing to spend $5 or $10 on something like that is probably the person that's still going to be around, you know, playing the game. Like, the whatever, I'm going to make up a number, but like, let's say 5 million people play that game at launch and there's 400,000, 500,000 playing it 3 months from now. That's probably the audience that would have bought that stuff anyway.
Do you think they'll add a Battletoad?
I hope they add a Battletoad. Some of the more cynical IGN readers propose that they're withholding microtransactions for 3 months to avoid the review release period.
Well,
because there's such a stigma against microtransactions.
Yeah. There's been cases of...
Or just avoid the negative discussion, not the reviews. I mean, like, there can be negative discussion outside of reviews, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a stigma. I mean, it sounds like everything they're doing it sounds like World of Warcraft, but it also sounds like it's not Battlefront.
Yeah, not Star Wars Battlefront.
Like, that's what you should do right now. If there's a negative reaction to a game out there that basically, you know, ruined that game's sales.
But I guess, yeah, and I guess I also... No, I was just saying, I think the cats sound cute. And if it were available at launch, but I had to pay extra for it, that'd probably rub me the wrong way.
Mm. Yeah, I suspect you're right. I bet it has less to do with reviews and more to do with, like, well, they also know that they're going to sell most of what they're going to sell in the first 3 months.
Yeah. Anyway.
Can you give the kitties, like, little scritches? Do we know yet?
Well, Justin was
saying...
Because
that's the sale for me.
Why don't you
try
to get that exclusive for us?
Yeah. Justin was saying...
IGN, you can pet the cats.
It should be illegal.
I'd run it.
To have dogs in your game if you can't pet the dogs.
Yeah, I
that's a weird situation, right? When you can't pet the dog.
It's I really don't want the government involved in my video game industry, but please, so who am I? Who I need to call my senator and let them know there's a game out. Dianne Feinstein, there's dogs in Zelda, but you can't pet them.
Yeah.
She's like, who is this? Get out of my office.
Stop calling.
You can
this
pet
number.
The cat in Stardew Valley or dog if you choose to have a dog. But you don't actually see it. The cat just gives you a little
hearts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you see the cat. You just don't see the there's no pet animation.
That's
yeah.
borderline. That's like something that would like get taken to court, right? And we'd argue minimum, about it.
Minimum viable like, product.
Yeah.
Minimum viable pet.
All right. Let's check in with listeners.
Hey.
Listeners.
Remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@ign.com, just like Archie from Ireland did.
Cool.
He says, been watching the show for years now. I love it. Keep it up. My question to you guys is whether or not it would be harder for someone like myself to break into the games industry compared to you guys.
Mm.
Being only 21, my knowledge of games really starts at the PS2 and Xbox generation. My favorite games include Shadow of the Colossus, Metal Gear Solid 3, Dark Souls, Bioshock, and Hotline Miami. However, I've never owned a Nintendo console or really been around to experience the classic games of the Nintendo 64 and PS1 era. Do you think knowledge of these games is necessary to break into the industry? I hear you guys talk about them all the time. Yeah,
well,
I know. And yet I've hardly played any of them. Unlike films, old games are very hard to get a hold of. And even if you can, it's usually quite expensive to do so. So I feel like I'm missing out on a vital part of gaming history. Do you think this will affect other people my age from getting a foothold in the gaming or gaming journalism industry?
Mm. Well, it's a really important distinction whether you're talking about journalism or
game
making.
Two very different skill sets required.
I mean, we look for hunger in people for knowledge. And I think that's a really important part of covering anything that you're passionate about. And I didn't grow up with arcades, and arcade games are fascinating to me, and I love them. It has nothing to do with what era you're born in. Do your research, figure that stuff out. But also, you know, you having the context of where you grew up and what you played is interesting, no matter what. It doesn't matter what you didn't play. It matters what you have to say about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're just as hireable as anybody else.
You know, Sam, if you were interviewing an applicant for IGN editorial and they were big fans of Shadow of the Colossus, Metal Gear Solid 3, Dark Souls, Bioshock, Hotline Miami, but they never played Super Mario Brothers 2, would you be like, you're out?
It's obviously totally fine. And like, you would never ask somebody to, you know, explain their game history. We want to know what your opinion is of games that are out now, because that's what we talk about. Yeah. Except for on Game Scoop during 20 questions.
I was going to say, well,
there's one exception.
Scoop in particular, you know, we skew a little bit older in our interests, right?
And our ages. So
yeah,
that's just
I bet I haven't played some of your guys' favorite classic games.
Yeah, likewise.
It's fun. Yeah.
There you go.
People have different tastes and experiences.
I mean, it's definitely, I don't ever feel old except when we're doing like top 100 meetings at IGN. And, you know, we have a tendency to have a little bit younger staff and we hire younger. And that's just, it's just what our makeup is typically. And when half or more of the staff, you know, isn't familiar with, you know, some of the, what I would consider some of the all-time greats, then I do start to feel a little old. But, we spend the bulk, our bread and butter is current games, you know, and so it doesn't, it's fine.
I would expect people to be able to contextualize features of games in history. That's important when you're critically evaluating a game. To come out and say, oh, this game I like, it's, you know, it's doing everything for the first time and be wrong about that. Obviously, you don't want to be wrong about that. You need to have some kind of understanding of history, but do that research while you're doing the project. You don't need to come to the job with that.
Sure. Yeah.
And as for the games development side of it, I've never worked in game dev myself, but I talked to a lot of game developers. I know a lot of game developers. I went to school for game design. I think it's like a little bit of a just like reading makes you a good writer, watching or makes you a better writer. Like exposing yourself to a lot of different things definitely gives you kind of like a larger mindset to think about that sort of stuff. But I also know indie game developers who very vocally say, you don't have to play games or like games to make games, right? Like there are people who, maybe that's not everybody, and I'm sure that a lot of game developers really do like and play games, but like those are not necessarily requisites, right? You don't have to have played every Mario game in the world. Like even, what was it? Didn't Nintendo say that they actively hire people who are maybe not gamers so that they can kind of get that breadth? I think that doesn't necessarily gate you out of it just because you haven't played old games.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Especially like if you wanted to work at Epic on Fortnite, I don't know how valuable deep knowledge of Bubsy would be for that role.
Detrimental, maybe.
It might actually hurt your game design.
I would say game journalism, it's more important to have, I would say, you know, to have
just
a
like,
wide
breadth just of like film like criticism, right?
Yeah,
like
but game development, you know, you just need to know like it's artistic chops or programming chops or, you know, whatever it may be. And I don't think it's as important to, you know, be super up to speed on dozens and dozens of 80s and 90s games.
Yeah, I think that's true. All right, this is Corey from Georgia. First time, long time, all that jazz. I work in a similar field and have a question to see if we share a similar problem. He doesn't tell us, but I wonder what a similar field is to what we do.
Maybe it's pizza making.
He says, do you find it hard to live in the now when it comes to video games? For example, you talk about a game so much leading up to its release, and even if it's great, there's always that next game that you have to talk about. I personally have found it difficult to enjoy new releases as my vision is always moving forward to the next release.
Definitely pizza.
Yeah. Well,
pizza industry.
Sam, you in particular.
I'm always trying to eat the next pizza.
You've been on a crusade over the last 12 months or so to sort of adjust how we think about this at IGN and remind people, especially if like a review embargo is early. Like sometimes we get a game 2 weeks before it comes out and we're allowed to put our review up a week before it comes out. And then we have to kind of remind people, hey, that game is out today. You know,
so
that
funny
game that we were talking about in the office, you know, 2 weeks ago in some instances, and sometimes we don't get a game early at all. But we do have to go through that process of like, what's the public mindset and how is that time shifted a little bit different than our mindset internally amongst the staff?
I'm sure you guys remember reading IGN and other sites and kind of having the writer lord over you that we got this game early. That is not what we want to do here.
No.
And we get that thrown back at us sometimes, like, hey, you know, you guys have access to everything. Why should I, you know, trust you? Well, the voice we are going for is that we, you know, we take our jobs very seriously when we criticize games. And it's good to have them early because we can do more with them and we can evaluate them more clearly. But yeah, we definitely don't want to have the voice of like lording it over people.
Yeah,
I mean, we all are lucky enough. I guess I can't speak for you three. I'm a video game fan, personally.
I don't care for myself.
I mean, I'm just an enthusiast, so it's exciting and fun, and that feeling of like having something like before some other people, like that's definitely a perk of the job. Like I won't deny that, but that's not really what it's about. It really is about like we need it, like we need that access to prep the guide content and make sure that the review is ready to go, and all the other stuff that we want to deliver to the audience. It's necessary to try and prep as much of that as we can, and if you go to IGN.com, you're gonna have what you need on that game when you bring that game home from your house.
I feel like I play as many games after they come out as I do before they come out, though.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I have the
don't have access. Like, if 10 people in the office are playing a game, the other 200 aren't, you know?
Yeah.
So.
I feel a little guilty. I have the opposite problem. Like, I've been playing Dwarf Fortress a ton lately. And I'm like, that's not relevant to anything at all that's happening in this office.
Dwarf Fortress is always relevant. Well, Dwarf Fortress will be relevant till the earth burns up.
Yeah,
man.
That's a really,
you
really
probably
good
stay thing. A little bit ahead of everybody, right? You have the Steam access.
Yeah, I try to play. I mean, I try to play a lot of stuff. Like, I had a resolution earlier at the beginning of this year. My resolution for 2018 was to play a game I've never played every day.
Every day?
No, you
every
can do it. There were 7,500 games on Steam last year.
I could pull out the dock. I think I'm at least up to 30 or 40 games this year. I'm not doing every day anymore because, in a weird way, it was affecting the way I was playing games, or I was like, oh, I can't play this game I already liked because I need to play a new one. So I stopped doing that. But, like, yeah, to his point, I try to live in the now more than I do live in, like, the past or the future. Like, I love playing whatever's come out this week. I'll just try to, like, dig into as much as I can, and then, like, the next week comes and it's hard, right? Like, it's hard to go back for stuff sometimes, and that makes me sad when there are so many good games coming out. Like, there's a game that I started playing for the first time last night called Crossing Souls, and I'm playing this game and I'm like, this game might be great, and I know I'm never gonna finish it.
What was that whaling card game?
Nantucket.
Nantucket.
Nantucket's a cool game. I have not gone back and played that though yet.
So many rhymes.
It's on my backlog.
All right, one more email this week. This is from Rachel in Trinidad and Tobago.
Cool.
I don't know how she can be in two places. But she says, recently there's been a lot of talk online about games pushing back the release dates to avoid that window in October when Red Dead Redemption 2 is slated to come out. It seems the wisest thing to do. Remember in 2015, Rise of the Tomb Raider was obliterated from the cultural conversation by Fallout 4. It seems if you want your game to survive, you got to make way for juggernauts or you'll get steamrolled. So I've been thinking about competing media. Take, for instance, the new Jumanji movie. It's been an unprecedented success, making over $880 million at the box office so far. Many didn't think it would stand a chance, considering there was a Star Wars movie out at the same time, but it held its own. I know movies and video games are two different industries, but seeing two blockbusters compete and do extremely well is interesting. It makes me wonder if there's a space in the gaming industry for something like that to happen. So my question, do you think there's any AAA video game that can be released around or on the same day with a Rockstar game and hold their own? Yeah, Call of Duty.
Well, but I was going to say probably something that occupies a different, like a Nintendo, like a Mario, you know, something counter-programming is example, right? Like something that's going to occupy really different space in the gamers' minds and a different portion of, as Rachel said, the cultural conversation.
Interestingly, we haven't gotten a date for Kingdom Hearts yet this year. I think if Kingdom Hearts wanted to release near Red Dead, it probably would still be talked about.
Yeah,
probably a good example of counter-programming.
They're more similar games than maybe like a Nintendo game, but also it's like a different audience, different kind of vibe to it, different pace to it.
Good
I call. Think.
Yeah, totally.
There was I thought Rachel was going to go a different direction with that conversation, where do these big entertainment releases across different mediums need to worry about each other more often now? We had that apocalyptic day last fall where it was, what, Mario and Assassin's Creed and a big Punisher?
Stranger Things,
excuse me. And then maybe a movie, too. And it's like for a site like IGN that covers everything, like that's a problem. But if you're someone making a movie or a game, I don't know, I'd be curious to find out how much they worry about, you know, Activision's not just competing with EA. It's like any time you're spending time with something else, that's time you're not spending with, you know, Rainbow Six Siege, for example. So is that a consideration of theirs? Like, is Netflix a threat to game makers?
Yeah, I think for sure, right? Well, just like,
I just don't know how much they consider stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Netflix is so opaque about their scheduling.
I think it must be. Just like Twitch, I think, is a threat to traditional cable broadcasters, right? I don't know if you saw the news today, but like Twitch is getting higher concurrence now than like MSNBC.
Networks. Yeah.
And or is it a threat to certainly the makers of single player games? But it'll just sit and watch them be played instead.
I think your Kingdom Hearts can go up against
Kingdom Hearts,
Dead, and it should be fine.
Yeah.
Maybe Overwatch 2.
But we still don't know when Kingdom Hearts is coming out, right?
We don't even know if 2018. If it's coming out this year.
You know, Bobby Kotick or one of those guys, if you're listening,
let
me know.
He's a big fan.
I'd be curious to find out how much you pay attention to, you know, Hollywood and television when you're thinking about when to release your games.
Is Bobby Kotick still the head of Activision?
No one knows.
And that brings us to Video Game 20 Questions. Tom, you know how this works?
I know how 20 questions works.
It's a video game that you're trying to guess.
Then yes, I know how this works.
Tom's played versions of this 20 questions game. When I go out after the show,
yeah.
I walk up to the wider staff and I say, "All right, the game has this, 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 and this. What is it?" And then people argue about it. It's really fun.
Yeah.
So that's the internal follow up to 20 questions.
Yeah, that's part of the metagame.
Yeah.
Is it bigger than a bread box? Doesn't apply to video
no.
games.
No. Yeah, it could though.
This week's suggestion comes from Elijah in Pennsylvania, and he says, "Since you mentioned AOL email addresses last week, I knew it was the right time to finally send in my 20 questions game suggestion. Let the questioning begin."
But well, Damon, if someone wants to send in a 20 question suggestion,
they would send them to the email address gamescoop@ign.com.
My favorite. So if he has an AOL address, that means you probably played games longer ago than you'd expect.
It means you're an old.
One of the olds.
Does your character wear a hat?
No.
Whoa, you're very sure.
Yep.
All right.
Can't get a hat on this character.
No.
Did this game, there are so many good suggested questions recently. I can't remember.
They always fly immediately out of my head the moment we get in.
No, there are some really good ones.
One of them was cart or CD.
Yeah, was this released on cartridge?
No.
All right. Well.
Are you ready to guess?
How elaborate can I get? It just has to be a yes or no answer, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope Tom really just gums up the works.
Well, okay, so since he said the AOL thing.
Like, it's not a cartridge.
Right.
Well, we were mostly joking about the AOL thing.
Yeah. I guess, but I was thinking maybe what if it's not a console game?
Console generation's confused.
I don't know the difference.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a good suggestion. Numbers.
I just need to research, Andres. Thank you for that.
Okay, well, I would you? This is going to be a weird question that you might not know the answer to.
Here we go.
I'm trying to ask if it's an old classic.
All right, my turn.
Game. No. Wait. Like, so with the AOL question, this is like, would you play this game with like dial-up modem? Right? Like, is it like a classic era PC game like that?
Hold on. You need to simplify your question.
How about, is it a PC game?
Is it bigger than a bread box?
You want to ask if it's a PC
game? Is it a PC game?
No.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to assume that it's a CD-based game.
Okay.
Based off of, it's not on a cart, but it could be digital only. I've decided I don't like the carts.
The carts digital only are floppy disk.
Yeah.
A phonograph record.
Because now,
there were a few.
Whatever. Okay. Was this game released after January 1st, 2010?
Yes.
Wow. That's okay. Not on cartridge.
No.
Not Switch.
But it could still be digital only.
It's not Switch or 3DS.
Could be iPhone. Could be Angry Birds.
Could be. It's probably Angry Birds. What about the hats?
I don't think any of those birds wear hats. One of them explodes.
Was this on consoles?
Yes.
Angry Birds was also on consoles, I want to point out.
Nailed it.
The strategy of like getting elaborate or not, right? Like how much do you hone in?
Well, we know it's after 2010, so I mean, you're welcome to ask what question you want. I'd like to zero in on console.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, like, is it a Nintendo game?
What do you mean by a Nintendo game?
What was it, a Nintendo exclusive?
No.
I want to know if it's developed in Japan.
I'm going to waste all your questions. I apologize to everyone.
But you
want to
get to consoles first.
Well, I mean, we can do whatever. I don't care. That's the big secret about all of this.
This like marriage, Justin. You just never say, I don't care.
Not important to me. Whatever happens, happens.
Call the cops.
Happy Valentine's Day. Is it a multi-platform game?
Yes.
Wow, we are not narrowing this down at all. So, Damon, tell me, was this game developed in Japan?
Yes.
Multi-platform.
Still doesn't help us very much, Tom. Don't get too excited.
Well, but that means
it's not Angry Birds.
That means it's not Angry Birds. It's Finnish? So that means not Sony, not Nintendo.
Why not Sony? Oh, because
it's a third party.
Right.
It's a multi-platform game.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Is combat the primary thing in this game, like fighting?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
That rules out a lot of stuff for me.
That's actually a pretty good question.
What was the Nintendo one? Did you do published?
I just asked if it was a Nintendo exclusive, but now we know it's cross-platform or multi-platform, which
it's
I should have just asked to begin
it's
with.
It's not Nintendo exclusive. Okay. All right. So combat is a focus. You don't wear a hat.
Multi-platform.
After 2000.
Mm-hmm. 2010.
Is this on is this on current? Is this on the Xbox One, PS4 generation of consoles?
No. Mm. That's 10.
Does this have realistic graphics?
Yeah. Yes.
Red.
Tom's making the same face I make whenever. Sam, that's like your go-to question.
Well, so if he says no, then like it's really nice to have the cell-shaded stuff out of the way. And, or, I mean, it's always nice to go down that route. But I don't know.
Fair enough. Okay, so 360 PS3 game, possibly PC game, made in Japan, fighting things.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, I don't know if I want to burn a question on this.
Made in Japan.
Yeah.
Does a robot suit count as a hat? Are you in some sort of mech or robot suit?
No.
Okay.
Do you, okay. Do you, are you shooting things with guns in this game? Are you shooting projectiles in this game?
If there is, that's not your primary form of attack.
Okay.
If there are guns in the game, there'll be like a secondary.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're slashy. Is it Metal Gear Rising?
Yeah. Devil May Cry.
Yeah, Devil May Cry.
Yeah, that's where my brain was going too.
I mean, if combat's the focus.
But that doesn't mean it's action. It just says there is combat in it.
No.
I said like it was if that was the main thing you did in the game.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. Fighting.
Fighting around the world.
Does this game have a sequel or sequels?
No.
What?
One off.
There might be guns in it, but it's not primarily a gun game. Made in Japan, multi-platform. Mm-hmm. No hats or robot suits.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? It's like Dragon's Dogma. Mm-hmm. Fighting a lot of things in that game.
I mean, we can go with fantasy or sci-fi if you want to do that.
Yeah, okay. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, the realistic graphics. Okay, so is this game set in like a, you know, realistic Earth-like setting?
Yes. That's 15.
Oh, man.
So I think Yakuza has some sequels, so it's not that.
Oh, Yakuza. Yeah, we screwed up Yakuza a couple weeks ago, didn't we? Many sequels to Yakuza, though.
Or Sleeping Dogs.
Could absolutely be Sleeping Dogs.
Yes. Is this 7 open world?
Yeah, but you shoot the heck out of things in Sleeping Dogs.
What
about an open world question?
Yeah.
Does this have an open world?
No.
Okay.
When did the Wii come out again?
That would have been, this is Wii U generation.
Okay.
Because this is Wii U, Xbox 360, PS3.
Okay.
We're assuming a little bit, but hopefully it's that. And we'll be okay.
We're in real trouble here.
Mm.
The realistic-ish graphics and sort of set on a contemporary Earth, and it's a Japanese-made game, and it's
is it like one of the Killer 7 type games? You know, who's that developer?
Capcom.
Suda. Is it a Suda game? Right.
Well, you're not asking.
That's not what I'm asking. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm just like I'm thinking. That's kind of realistic.
I mean, what? No more.
But not the right graphics, right?
So graphics. Does No More Heroes fit all the criteria?
But not realistic not graphics. No.
Yeah. Good call.
Yeah.
Because
that's where I was going with it with the Wii question. But yeah. Oh man, this is stressful. How do you guys do this every week?
Well, we win every week. All right.
Oh, that's my bad. So this is you're telling me this is on me?
So
yes. Oh no.
I don't think it can be any of the FromSoft games because none of them are set on a contemporary Earth-like planet, mm-hmm. as far as I know.
I thought it was like going to be Vanquish, but Vanquish has no robot suits.
Yeah.
That's why I asked that. Man.
So combat, should we ask if it has like a sword or fists or something?
I'm assuming sword.
You're assuming sword?
Yeah.
We'll go with sword.
You can ask. We have 4 questions left.
Yeah.
Oh, we have 4?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're boned.
Yeah, probably.
Do you use a sword in this game?
No.
Whoa.
What?
Maybe it's a fighting game.
Oh, but does that? Oh, I guess we didn't ask that, did we?
This is a fighting game.
Wait. But there's no sequels. Doesn't every fighting game have a trillion sequels?
Not Skullgirls. But also the realistic graphics and stuff is like, it's tough. Tekken's and they have,
I'm trying to think of any fighting game from last gen that
He said it's not open
with
world.
The confidence with which he said no to the hat question makes me think that...
That's true. Fighting games have too many hats.
If he had to, so, if there was like a cast of characters, he'd have to think about that one for
a bit. But it's interesting. We sort of glossed over the fact that it's not open world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like something level, like, you know, whatever brawler. Like Ninja Gaiden. Don't use swords.
I just think it's something like Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, but that's a generation too old.
Or I mean, just that type, like that. The type of game.
I mean, they
Devil May Cry, Ninja Gaiden, they all have sequels.
Like Tenchu, right? Was that last gen?
Mm-hmm.
Three questions to go.
Yeah.
Should we do critically acclaimed?
Nah, it's never helpful to me. I mean, you can if you want. And you don't use a sword. Oh, I feel like we have all the puzzle pieces here, but I just can't.
Whoa.
They're swirling around.
One of the Darksiders games?
Not Japanese, right?
And oh,
they're
dang,
also not
in
contemporary Earth.
Aren't they? I thought one of them was.
Andres, what are you thinking?
But it wouldn't be because it's guns as a side thing, right? If there are guns,
a first-person puncher.
They've made those.
That game, yeah.
There's an Atlas one, right?
Fight Night is a game that's coming out. Fight with a K, Night with a K.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a cool-looking game that's coming out soon, actually.
All right.
Bring it home.
Is it? I don't have it.
What's?
The way he's just smiling and laughing is. Like,
I just wonder. Do you think we're gonna get this one?
I'm not confident.
Okay.
Is that a question? Was that a question?
No, no, that's a freebie.
Is this one we will get?
But I'm trying to think, should we ask about multiplayer? Does that help at all?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Does this have multiplayer?
This does not have multiplayer.
So single player game that is linear without swords on a semi-realistic Earth with a semi-realistic graphics.
From Japan.
Multi-platform from Japan.
Yep.
Not much gunplay.
Disaster Day of Crisis.
No sword, not much gunplay. What type of fighting game has no sword but not much gunplay?
A brawler.
Should we ask, like, no, because I guess.
Oh, really? Is this based on a license?
No.
Okay, so that'll help us guess the final one.
All right. Is there the last question?
19?
That was 19. So last question has to be the guess.
So.
What games were like, you know, Capcom and Konami and all these companies, you know, mucking around with back then?
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. I'm way.
No sequels is hard, man.
I'm way in left field. Asura's Wrath?
Yeah, that's the one with the big bosses. But that's not really contemporary Earth or realistic.
Is it not contemporary
graphics.
Earth? No, I didn't actually play it.
It had big monsters in it.
Yeah.
I was thinking like that and God Hand and stuff are really good. Red Steel.
God Hand's a generation too old. So is Red Steel, actually. But
totally.
And Red Steel's totally a shooter.
I'm
but
just
I
trying
like...
to think of games like that.
Yeah.
Zombie game?
Yeah. Like, what's the one that the Wii U launched with?
Ooh, Dead Rising.
Zombie.
That doesn't have sequels.
Dead Rising got a sequel, but
Zombie U.
That's what it is.
Could be Zombie U. No, but that's Ubisoft.
And that came to...
Oh, it wasn't Japanese at all?
No, and it got ported.
Mm. That's okay, because it can come to multiple consoles.
Yeah. But I've been so hung up on contemporary Earth being like, you know, a realistic setting.
Yeah,
it could
still
be contemporary.
He hesitated on Earth. He was thinking about it.
Playing.
So I think zombie. I mean, does whatchamacallit? Does Last of Us count? That kind of has guns, I guess.
Well, that's not Japanese either.
Oh, I keep forgetting about that part. Keep forgetting about that part.
So there is Dead Rising, and there is Dead Island.
Dead Rising got a sequel.
And Dead Island got a sequel. Well, a spinoff.
Hats, though, guys.
And Dead Island 2.
No hats, for sure. Like, so you're a character in this game. It's not one of those, like, I'm an anonymous person games.
You also shoot the heck out of things in both of those games.
Dead Rising also had kind of an open world.
Sequels.
So that one's just outright. I'm going down the wrong path here. I'm leading us astray.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we're going to get this one. Did we say the name of it?
You guys came very close twice.
Okay.
How about that?
If we came close twice.
No, it's too late. Can't you?
Yeah, what is it?
And it was actually Tom that got you there both times.
Yeah.
Tom got you there twice. He came by, he said, Suda 51.
Yeah.
And he came by and said, zombies.
Was it a Suda 51 zombie game?
It was
Lollipop Chainsaw.
Lollipop Chainsaw.
Oh, I got it. Man!
I wouldn't call that realistic graphics.
Oh,
they're going straight up cartoon.
I think they're going for realistic graphics. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to like as opposed to like cel shaded.
I thought it was cel shaded.
No.
Okay.
No. Compared to Suda's other games, yeah. That's a realistic graphic yeah. game.
I think yeah, you reviewed that really game. Didn't you?
No, I didn't review. I've never played that game.
No hat.
You're the cheerleader.
Yeah, I know.
She doesn't wear a hat.
Pigtails. Should we pigtails? Ask the pigtails question from here?
Yeah.
Your character so the pigtails. Focus is, it is a Bayonetta-like, like chainsaw.
So she has a chainsaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a not a sword or a gun.
I think we were there with Devil May Cry and everything. We knew what type of game it was.
Yeah, it is that type of game. It's a hack and slash, linear hack and slash game.
Yeah. Tough, man.
Yeah.
Published by Warner Brothers, that game.
Wow,
but developed by developed by Grasshopper in Japan.
Yeah. Oh, man, I just Googled it.
Yeah.
Safe search.
Can be a dangerous one to Google, that one. Lollipop Chainsaw. Good suggestion. Elijah from Pennsylvania. The AOL email threw you off.
I think if they stump us, they should get something.
Yeah. What should it be?
I don't know.
Good pat on the back.
Yeah.
How about we make an anagram of their name?
So Elijah, what's you work on that while I read about the DICE Awards, which are airing exclusively on IGN next week, February 21st and 22nd at the DICE Awards. VIPs of the gaming industry like Phil Spencer, Neil Druckmann from Naughty Dog will be presenting on the future of the industry and giving out the DICE Awards. Nominated for Game of the Year this year is Cuphead, Horizon, PUBG, Mario Odyssey, and Breath of the Wild. And the IGN is the place where you can stream all the talks and the awards. The two-day stream kicks off on February 1st, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific, right here at IGN. And then the 2018 DICE Awards commence February 22nd at 8 p.m. Pacific.
So I have the anagram. 21st.
What did I say?
February 1st.
February 21st, yes.
I have the anagram.
Okay, for Elijah.
So his punishment for stumping us is that we should jail he.
Jail he! Yes, and with that, that is all the scoops that we have for you this week. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@IGN.com. My name is Damon. This is IGN GameScoop, and we're out.
Dear stranger, I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.